So when we talk to each other about our jobs, our careers, you know, the things that we do for a living, it is really kind of this way for us to learn about the other person's identity, right? It's kind of a non-invasive way of maybe getting that conversation going as you're trying to discover who this person is. You ask a pretty common question, and one that we learn, you know, in many different ways early on. You know, it's kind of normal civil conversation. You know, what do you do for a living? What is your job? What do you do? And perhaps in learning that, we begin to learn that, you know, whatever our job is going to be eventually, that it really has this huge tie into who we are as a person. It defines us. And so thus we begin, for some of us, this decades-long journey in trying to discover what that job, what that career, what that title is going to be. Because in our culture, it's such a strong identification of who we are as a person. So as we try to figure out who we're going to be, we are taught in one way or another that part of the way that we can figure that out is whatever our job or our career, you know, what it is that we're going to be doing for a living. That is part of what defines who we will become. And so, you know, we all know that question when we're asked, what are you going to do when you grow up? That's kind of also the question, who are you going to be when you grow up? And so, of course, how we answer that question. So when someone asks us, you know, what do? We usually say, I am. What are you going to do? What do you do? I'm a doctor, or I'm a scientist, or I'm a pastor, whatever. We don't say that I pastor or I doctor. We say that that's who we are, even though what we've been asked is, what do? So in the last few years, we have actually seen some notable changes, though, in this tradition. The way that we go through education, you know, the timing, the methods, the way that we pursue careers and jobs, because, you know, for many reasons nowadays, we no longer really expect that we're going to be in the same job or even the same place for the next 30 to 40 years. Many people are entering the workforce today not really looking for one job that will define them, but really a series, you know, kind of a portfolio of experiences. They do not want their work to define them. They want their work to be an extension of who they are as a person, even if it doesn't really pay anything. Now, to some of us, perhaps those of us who are parents, that doesn't really seem like the best idea. It may seem kind of impractical or unrealistic, and you know what? That might be totally true. It's not the wisest move, maybe, to make. It's certainly not the safest. And yet, on the other hand, how many times have we ourselves come home, you know, deflated or de-energized, wishing that our jobs, our lives, our decisions could be different? How many times have we wished that we could have done something, but maybe we felt held back because of the threat of job security or something along those lines? When have we been faced with the chance to stand up for something, but we did not take it? And thus, as a human being, we are filled with regret. This is where we get into the story of Esther. Now, again, we may not all know Esther's story. We may only know that it is in the Old Testament. And so hopefully this will be a chance for us to maybe see that maybe the Old Testament is not as boring or as stuffy or as violent as, you know, maybe we sometimes think it is. So to start off, Esther's real name is actually a Jewish name, because, of course, she herself is Jewish. So her real name is Hadassah, which means myrtle, like the myrtle tree. So back when the Babylonians enslaved the Israelites, when they were able to get out of the exile, they actually took this tree with them, and they made it a national symbol of Israel. It was a kind of a, you know, sticking out their tongue at Babylon, saying, we're going to take your tree. And so it became this national symbol in Israel. And so that's where Hadassah comes from. But of course, you know, Esther is a Persian name from the Persian Empire. It means star and happiness. So this is the name that she typically has gone by. Now, without getting too much into it, a little bit of background. So most of us know of the Babylonian exile, right? The Babylon comes in, they destroy Israel and Judah, and they force the Jewish people to become slaves and come into Babylon. They're exiled. at some point, the Persian Empire comes in and they defeat Babylon. So now the Babylonian Empire has become the Persian Empire. So when that happens, the Jewish people are free to either go back home, which of course many of them do, but some actually end up staying. They stay in the Persian Empire, and this is where Esther starts to come in. Her parents die, and so she is adopted by her uncle Mordecai. Mordecai eventually becomes an advisor to the king of Persia, King Ahasuerus. And so Esther herself becomes part of the king's harem, or these group of female servants who are supposed to serve the king. Eventually, the king chooses a new wife, and it ends up being Esther. Hence, she becomes the queen, Queen Esther. So just a little bit of snapshot with this king. King Ahasuerus was known as enjoying debauchery and exuding authority over women. And not only did he like doing that himself, he liked issuing decrees to the people, saying to men, you know, as husbands, hey, do this to your wives as well. So that's kind of the king this guy is. So years after Esther becomes the queen, there is a guy by the name of Haman, who is one of the prime ministers in Persia and one of the king's favorite people. So he obtains this royal decree that authorizes the slaughter of all the Jews in the Persian land, in the Persian Empire. So one of the reasons that he does this is he has a personal grudge with Mordecai. Mordecai is the type of guy who does not bow to his authority. He doesn't recognize him at all. Haman takes this personally, and then he eventually sees this opportunity not only to get rid of Mordecai, but to get rid of all of his people when he finds out that Mordecai is Jewish. So when Mordecai himself hears about this, he pleads for help to Esther, the queen. But of course, the fear is for Esther that if she does anything, if she says anything, the king is going to find out that she too is Jewish. And so this is where we come into today's part of Esther's story. So Mordecai and all the Jews in the land, when they hear this is going to happen, they participate in this ritual that Israelites use that was usually held for grieving the loss of the loved one. So if you're a Jewish person in this time, you hear or find out that someone you loved has died, you tear your clothes, you put on sackcloth, you know, you sit in the ground, you cut your hair. There's all of these actions that you take to sort of embody the grief that you are feeling. All of these people are doing it sort of in a way of anticipating their own death. And so as a way of expressing their fear, their anxiety, they go through this ritual. It's like they have already died. So Esther's maids hear about this. They see what's happening, what Mordecai and the people are doing. They go to Esther and they say what's going on. The English text in our scriptures usually says something like Esther was deeply distressed. It's a little bit more than that. The ancient Hebrew word actually is more about Esther feeling the kind of pain that women feel in childbirth. It's this deep anguish. And so I wondered, you know, why does our English version kind of gloss over that? And there could be many reasons. I wonder if maybe part of it is that Esther was feeling this inwardly, but she could not express this outwardly. Not just because of the fear that, you know, someone might see her being so grief-stricken and wonder, you know, why does she care? But just as her responsibility as a queen. I mean, when you have that role and that responsibility, you cannot always exude what it is that you are feeling inside because of your role and because of your responsibility. You have to keep a brave face or you have to keep composure. You cannot always express your individuality as a person because of the role and the responsibilities you have. So Esther is aware that she has to keep it all together. She knows that in order to move forward, she cannot let herself be overcome with emotion because she knows of her responsibilities and her call to save her people. And so how she experienced all of this grief, how she embodies this distress, this anguish, how internal or external it was, we don't really know. The story doesn't necessarily tell us. We do know that she responds by providing her uncle with clothing, and she tells them that she cannot approach the king unless he first invites her. Now, this was the way it happened in the empire. Even the queen could not approach the king without first being invited, being summoned to do so. Even if she, the queen, were to speak uninvited, it would mean her banishment, maybe even her death. She says, only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone, may that person live. I myself have not been called to come to the king for 30 days. So for 30 days, she hasn't even seen or talked to her husband. But Mordecai pleads with Esther to use her power, to use her authority, to somehow change the king's mind. But Esther is so enclosed in this Persian Empire, she didn't even realize what was going on until her servants, her maids, came and told her. And this communication between her and Mordecai, it's all being passed through by notes and by messages. They're not even speaking to each other face to face. But at this point, Mordecai is pretty much done with all the policies and procedures and the etiquettes and all of that because there is so much at stake. You have to do something, he tells Esther. You have to do something. Now, at this point, Esther has been a queen for about 5 years, and she has followed all the edicts. She has followed all the policies. She has done everything that has been expected of her, but now she is being called to something more, something greater. Something that goes beyond her role, something that goes beyond her title and beyond her expectations. Is that something that we ever deal with? You know, fast forwarding thousands of years, is this something that we ever encounter? Is this a challenge, a question, a struggle? How do we balance our work life and our human life? How do we balance our role and our identity? It's one thing to talk about this in a story that happened thousands of years ago, but we also know that there are modern versions of this. And so we've asked some in our congregation to kind of talk about their experience of how this has happened. So I'd like to invite Kaylin O'Leary to come forward. Kaylin has agreed to share some of her story of how it is that we balance who we are in our job and who we are as a person.
Like Amy said, I'm Kaylin O'Leary. When he asked me to come speak about this, it was kind of hard because I was like, I don't think I do that well. I think a lot of you know I'm a nurse. And when you choose to go into a line of service, I think anybody in a profession that is more of a service profession, it becomes who you are. I'm a daughter. I'm a sister. I'm a friend. I'm an aunt. But I'm also a nurse. And in all of those relationships, my profession has, like, bled into them. And I think the first time I really realized how true that was when my 5-year-old nephew called me because he had fallen and scraped his knee and he wanted to make sure his mom did a good job of bandaging it. So then it was like, okay, even the 5-year-old, that's what he identifies. I'm his aunt. He identifies me as the one that knows how to fix the boo-boos. So it's something I really struggle with. But Meg said something to me earlier that kind of, like, really hit home. I'm a helper. That was the gift that was given to me. And knowing that, like, with nursing, that's what I can do for people. So I'm trying to do it on crying. So it gets hard sometimes. Like, how do you separate it? So there are times when people in your life, your loved ones, get sick, and you have to step up. You have to be the one that's there to help them. And it's hard to separate between both sides of things. I did not think I was going to cry doing this. So I think knowing that when you're in those situations that it's a gift from God, but it's a very hard one, and learning how you can be there for people even when it's hard for you, and you leaning on God and your other friends that can be your support is something I've been able to do to help get through that. Then there's a part where it's just your career. Like, how do you have a work-life balance? I think that's sometimes hard, too, because you start feeling like you need to help people when you're at work. Like, oh, I can't leave yet because I need to do things. So that's been a struggle for me as well. But being able to have that line that, okay, I am here, I am working, I am a nurse, but then I need to be able to leave, I need to go home, and there are other people that can take over and do the same thing for me. It's not me, just me. So those have been my struggles. I don't think I do it well all the time. But, I think it's something that anybody in the line of service really, really struggles with. And I think it's just leaning on your faith in God and knowing that there's a reason you were put in this field. So now I think Ashley's going to come up and speak about kind of her role in something. Okay.
Kaylin's been our hero a few times, and some of you guys might know when you go to the hospital, like, if you know Kaylin, you're like, Kaylin, help. And so thank you for that. That was amazing. If you guys don't know me, I'm Ashley Hearn. I'm Jeremy's wife. He was up here playing earlier. And if you asked me who I am, you know, when I first moved here, I would tell you probably three things. One is I'm a professional dancer. Two is I have a spa business. And then three, I'm really a people person. I love to go, go, go. I do not like being bored. I cannot sit at home. I'm not like a napper. Just give me things to do. And so that was kind of my identity. And I come up here today to talk to you guys because I kind of had an identity crisis a year ago. I lost all of those things because I had a little baby. And so a few things happened. A month after I had a baby, the business that I built for 12 years just shut down unexpectedly. So it was taken away from me without, you know, any say. I was just like done. And so I had no goal-driven, you know, things that I was trying to do, no purpose in my mind. The second thing is when you're pregnant, you can't dance professionally. So that was that. And I thought I might not get to do that again because I didn't know how I would recover. And also my dance company is pretty far away, so I wasn't sure how my child would do if I did want to go back with the commute. And then the third thing is when you have a child at home, you're kind of isolated, right? Like I had no real things to do and you're by yourself a lot. And so really, I had to dig deep and say, like, well, who is Ashley now? Now I'm being asked to keep a human alive, and I'm not good at that. Like, who knows how to do that? I just have to learn, I guess. And so really what I realize is that my identity in Christ is the only thing that comes with me through the changes. And so in my life, I'm sure I'm going to have a time where, yeah, I'm too old to dance. I got to figure that out. And maybe another business might fail again. I don't know. And so I guess what I want to say is, you know, when I lose it all, it's like stripping circumstances, and that doesn't identify me anymore. I'm trying to figure out who I am without those things, you know, around me or the settings that I'm in. And so I don't know the answers yet, but I'm searching, trying to figure out the new mom me and, you know, trying to, you know, obviously get back to dancing, but those things are temporary, I guess, is the conclusion to that. So,
thank you, Kaylin and Ashley, for sharing that with us. And so we know that maybe we're not so like Esther that an entire civilization rests on our decision or our role, but we do know sometimes what it is to struggle, whether it's work-life balance or whether things are so overwhelming to us as a person, or we find ourselves so tied our identity into what we do, and then that changes. We think, who am I? I mean, certainly when we're faced with retirement, many of us may go through that identity crisis. And so we realize that it's a struggle, and we all go through it in some way. It's at this point that I want to remind us in the book of Esther that God is never mentioned, not once. Esther is like one of two books in what we have as the Bible that does not actually refer to God, at least specifically. So one of the conversations that's always about the book of Esther is, how is God maybe present even if God is not necessarily mentioned? So when Mordecai is pleading with Esther and trying to get her to change her mind and to do something, he says in one of his messages that she gets, if you keep silent at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish. And so the implication that Mordecai is saying is, you know, if Esther doesn't do something to save the people, someone or something will do it. Something or someone will rise to the occasion. But it's more than just this, you know, God will punish you if you don't do the right thing sort of message. Mordecai is reminding Esther that there might be more going on here than anyone realizes. And like any good story, it's not something that's explicit, but in the midst of tragedy, there might be room for something else. And this is where Mordecai says to her, who knows? Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for such a time as this. It may be at this point that Esther remembers who she really is, that she no longer needs to be defined by her title. She no longer needs to be defined by her role, but she uses that title and that role to answer her call. And so this is the moment where I would like to invite Jacques to come and read a very important message, and this is why we chose her to read it.
Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish.
Now that's a queen. Many of us have experienced times in our lives where we have felt trapped or lost in our job and who we were. Or maybe we have been faced with a decision that maybe threatened our job or our role or our title, our security. That moment in time when we were faced with a chance to reveal who we are by revealing what we believe. And then the threat of disagreement or embarrassment or the loss was too powerful. And so we kept silent. But we also may have had experiences where, like Esther, the stakes were just too high, our beliefs were too strong, and we simply could not remain silent. Or maybe we realized something in ourselves, and we lived more into ourselves than our expectations. Esther lived, for the most part, an ordinary life, even as a queen. She did what she was told. She lived out her role. She was obedient. And really, Mordecai did not know if she was going to do anything about her people or not. Who knows, he says. The point of today is not whether or not Esther succeeded, which, by the way, she did. Read the rest of the story because it's really good. But perhaps more importantly is the moment right here, when she decides who she will be and which direction she will go, and that she will decide what to do with her role and with her power. That is how Esther lived an extraordinary life. And so as we take this time going into the open table, the invitation to come to communion, I would like to invite Pastor Melissa, as she officiates and opens the table to us, to use that as an opportunity to share her words with us.
So I remember when I received my first appointment. And as part of the appointment process, before we moved there, we went to the church and had a variety of different meetings with different groups of people. And so my first meeting was with the Staff Parish Relations Committee. And so I sat with that group of people, who is like the personnel committee of the United Methodist Church. I sat with that group of people, and in their questioning me to get to know me, the question came to me, so how are you going to be a pastor and a mom at the same time? And in about 2 seconds before I opened my mouth and answered that question, I thought, oh shoot, how am I going to be a pastor and a mom at the same time? I may not be cut out for this. And at the same time, I thought, I wonder if they ask the men this same question. Which, by the way, they don't. And so all these questions, and I thought, how in the world am I going to answer this? And somehow, by the grace of God, the answer came. And I said, I have no idea. All I know is that God's called me to be a pastor, and God's called me to be a mother. and he's going to have to figure it out. And he has figured it out. Some days I'm a better pastor, and some days I'm a better mother. Some days I'm not good at either, and some days I rock both of them. But that's just two of the roles that I play, right? I'm mother and daughter and wife and granddaughter and neighbor and friend and pastor. And so there's all these different roles and identities that I carry with me. But the reality is I have to turn to that one identity or I'm going to be in big trouble no matter what. I have to turn to the identity that God's got it all figured out, that my identity is in Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior. And every time I turn to that identity, life is as it should be. So the one thing that I try to remember and I have to bring myself back to all the time is that I should have an audience of one, that audience of God, because my identity is in Christ and his love for me and for the world. And so we remember that love today as we come to the table together. Our identity is not in our profession. It's not in our age. It's not in our gender. It's not in the roles that we play. Our identity is in Jesus Christ. And through that, we will then be directed in how to live out all those different roles, all those different callings that God has given to us.
I happened to see Andy and Ashley McIntyre walk in this morning, which made me think of something. I asked permission, so he said it was okay. Andy, is, those of you may know, is Pastor David's son, phenomenal filmmaker, business owner, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, a few days ago, he posted on his Facebook that he said to his son, they were watching commercials, and he said to his son, Crosley, you know, my job is to make commercials. And Crosley's response was, my job is to love people. And I mean, that's it. I mean, that's exactly what Pastor Melissa was talking about. Our core identity, when you strip everything down, our identity, who we are, our job, if you want to use that word, is to fundamentally love people. That should be who we are and what we do. And everything else should extend and filter because of that. This is what we hope you experience when you are here and that we are able to take with us out into the world. And whatever our job, role, title, whatever word we want to use, fundamentally, we are about loving one another. So go. Don't let anything stop you. Don't let anything make you hesitate or make you feel like you are limited. And if you do, know that we are here to listen and to help you through that so that we may be who God calls us to be, which is people whose job it is to love one another. And may we go in peace. Amen.